Chapter 7 Sufficient Bliss. As France tottered, and German planes battered British and French forces massing at Dunkirk, Private Secretary John Colville struggled with a long-standing and, for him, wrenching quandary. He was in love. The object of his adoration was Gay Margesson, a student at Oxford and the daughter of David Margesson, the former appeaser whom Clementine Churchill had savaged over lunch. 2 years earlier, Colville had asked Gay to marry him, but she had declined, and ever since he had felt both drawn to her and repelled by her unwillingness to return his affections. His disappointment made him look for and find faults in her personality and behaviour. This did not stop him, however, from trying to see her as often as he could. On Wednesday, May 22nd, he telephoned her to confirm arrangements for the coming weekend, when he was to visit her at Oxford. She was evasive. She told him first that there was no point in his coming, because she would be working, but then changed her story and told him that there was something she planned to do that afternoon at school. He persuaded her to honour their plans, since they had arranged the visit weeks earlier. She relented. She did so with an ill grace, and I felt very hurt that she should prefer some miserable undergraduate arrangement which she had made at Oxford to seeing me, he wrote. It is extraordinary to be quite so inconsiderate about other people's feelings when one pretends to be fond of them. The weekend began on an optimistic note, however. He drove to Oxford on Saturday morning, through lovely spring weather suffused with sunshine. But as he arrived, clouds filled the sky. After lunch at a pub, he and Gay drove to Clifton Hampden, a village south of Oxford on the Thames, and spent time lying in the grass, talking. Gay was depressed about the war and the horror that seemed certain to come. Nevertheless, we enjoyed ourselves, Colville wrote, and for me it was sufficient bliss to be with her. The next day, they walked together on the grounds of Magdalen College and sat for a time talking, but the talk was dull. They went to her room. Nothing happened. She studied French. He took a nap. Later, they clashed over politics, Gay having recently declared herself a socialist. They strolled along the Thames, called Isis within the bounds of the city of Oxford, with its many punts and painted barges, until toward evening they found themselves at the Trout Inn, the Trout, for short, a 17th-century pub beside the river. The sun emerged and the weather turned glorious, Colville wrote, producing a blue sky, a setting sun, and enough clouds to make the sun still more effective. They dined at a table with views of a waterfall, an old bridge and an adjacent forest, then walked along a towpath as children played nearby and plovers called to one another. There has never been a more beautiful setting in which to be happy, Colville wrote, and I have never felt greater serenity or contentment. Gay felt likewise. She told Colville that happiness could only be attained if one lived for the moment. This seemed promising. But then, upon returning to her room, Gay reiterated her decision that she and Colville would never marry. He promised to wait in case she changed her mind. She urged me not to be in love with her, he wrote, but I told her that to have her as my wife was the greatest ambition I had, and that I could not give up crying for the moon when the moon meant everything in life to me. He spent Sunday night on a sofa in a cottage on the grounds of a nearby estate owned by the family of a sister-in-law, Joan. In London that evening, May 26th, just before 7 p.m, Churchill ordered the start of Operation Dynamo, the evacuation of the British Expeditionary Force from the French coast. In Berlin, Hitler directed his armoured columns to resume their advance against the BEF, which now crowded the port city of Dunkirk. His forces moved more tentatively than expected, content to let Göring's bombers and fighters finish the task at hand. But Göring harboured a distorted perception of what by now was unfolding off the coast of Dunkirk, as British soldiers, nicknamed Tommies, prepared to evacuate. "Only a few fishing boats are coming across," he said on Monday, May 27th. "One hopes that the Tommies know how to swim." Chapter 8 The First Bombs. The escape riveted the world. In his diary, the king kept the daily count of how many men had gotten away. The Foreign Office sent Roosevelt detailed daily updates. Initially, the Admiralty had expected that, at best, 45,000 men would escape. Churchill himself estimated a maximum of 50,000. The tally for the first day, just 7,700 men, seemed to suggest that both estimates were generous. The second day, Tuesday, May 28th, was better, with 17,800 men evacuated, but still nowhere near the kind of volume Britain would need to reconstitute a viable army. Throughout, however, Churchill never flagged. Far from it. He seemed almost enthusiastic. He understood, however, that others did not share this positive outlook. This was underlined on that Tuesday, when one member of his war cabinet said that the BEF's prospects looked blacker than ever. Recognizing that confidence and fearlessness were attitudes that could be adopted and taught by example, Churchill issued a directive to all ministers to put on a strong, positive front. In these dark days, the Prime Minister would be grateful if all his colleagues in the government, as well as high officials, would maintain a high morale in their circles, not minimizing the gravity of events, but showing confidence in our ability and inflexible resolve to continue the war till we have broken the will of the enemy to bring all Europe under his domination. Also that day, he sought to put an end, once and for all, to any thought of Britain seeking peace with Hitler. Speaking before 25 of his ministers, he told them what he knew about the impending debacle in France and conceded that even he had briefly considered negotiating a peace agreement. But now, he said, I am convinced that every man of you would rise up and tear me down from my place if I were for one moment to contemplate parley or surrender. If this long island story of ours is to end at last, let it end only when each of us lies choking in his own blood upon the ground. For a moment, there was stunned silence. Then, to a man, the ministers rose and mobbed him, slapping his back and shouting their approval. Churchill was startled and relieved. He was quite magnificent, wrote one minister, Hugh Dalton, the man and the only man we have for this hour. Here, as in other speeches, Churchill demonstrated a striking trait, his knack for making people feel loftier, stronger, and above all, more courageous. John Martin, one of his private secretaries, believed that he gave forth a confidence and invincible will that called out everything that was brave and strong. Under his leadership, Martin wrote, Britons began to see themselves as protagonists on a vaster scene and as champions of a high and invincible cause for which the stars in their courses were fighting. He did this on a more intimate level as well. Inspector Thompson recalled one summer evening at Chartwell, Churchill's home in Kent, when Churchill was dictating notes to a secretary. At some point, he opened a window to admit the cooling country breeze and inflew a large bat, which began wildly careening through the room, now and then diving at the secretary. She was terrified. Churchill was oblivious. At length, he noticed her convulsive ducking and asked if something was wrong. She pointed out the fact that the bat, a large and extremely hostile bat, Thompson wrote, was in the room. Surely you're not afraid of a bat, are you? Churchill asked. She was indeed afraid. I'll protect you, he said. Get on with your work. The evacuation from Dunkirk proved successful beyond imagining, aided by Hitler's pause order and by bad weather over the Channel, which thwarted the Luftwaffe. The Tommies did not, after all, have to swim. In the end, 887 vessels carried out the Dunkirk evacuation, of which only a quarter belonged to the Royal Navy. Another 91 were passenger ships, the rest an armada of fishing boats, yachts, and other small craft. In all, 338,226 men got away, including 125,000 French soldiers. Another 120,000 British soldiers still remained in France, including John Colville's older brother Philip, but were making their way toward evacuation points elsewhere on the coast. As successful as it was, the evacuation of the BEF was nonetheless deeply frustrating for Churchill. He was desperate to take the offensive. How wonderful it would be if the Germans could be made to wonder where they were going to be struck next, instead of forcing us to try to wall in the island and roof it over, he wrote to Pug Ismay, his military chief of staff. An effort must be made to shake off the mental and moral prostration to the will and initiative of the enemy from which we suffer. It can be no accident that in the midst of the evacuation, Churchill began adding red adhesive labels, exhorting "Action this day" to any minute or directive requiring an immediate response. These labels, wrote Secretary Martin, were treated with respect. It was known that such demands from the summit could not be ignored. On June 4th, the last day of the evacuation, in an address to the House of Commons, Churchill again turned to oratory, this time to bolster the empire as a whole. First, he applauded the success at Dunkirk, though he added a sober reminder, "Wars are not won by evacuations." As he neared the conclusion of the speech, he fired his boilers. "We shall go on to the end," he said, in a crescendo of ferocity and confidence. "We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." As the House roared its approval, Churchill muttered to a colleague, "And we will fight them with the butt end of broken bottles, because that's bloody well all we've got." His daughter Mary, who sat in the gallery that day beside Clementine, found the speech breathtaking. "It was now that my love and admiration for my father became enhanced by an increasing element of hero worship," she wrote. One young Navy man, Ludovic Kennedy, later to achieve fame as a journalist and broadcaster, recalled how, "When we heard it, we knew in an instant that everything would be all right."
Harold Nicholson wrote to his wife, Vita Sackville West,
"I feel so much in the spirit of Winston's great speech that I could face a world of enemies. Not, however, to the extent that he abandoned his plan for suicide. He and Vita planned to acquire some form of poison and, borrowing a phrase from Hamlet, a bare bodkin with which to administer it. He instructed her to keep her bodkin close at hand, so that you can take your quietus when necessary. I shall have one also. I am not in the least afraid of such sudden and honourable death. What I dread is being tortured and humiliated." As stirring as Churchill's speech was, it did not win the wholehearted approval of all. Clementine noted that a great section of the Tory party, the Conservative Party, did not react with enthusiasm, and that some even met the speech with sullen silence. David Lloyd George, a former Prime Minister and current Liberal Member of Parliament, called the reception very half-hearted. The next day, Home Intelligence reported that only two newspapers gave Churchill's speech headline value, and that the speech had done little to fortify the public. "The final evacuation of the BEF has brought with it a certain feeling of depression," the office noted. "There is a deflation of tension without a corresponding increase in resolve." The report found, further, that some apprehension has been caused throughout the country on account of the PM's reference to fighting alone. This has led to some slight increase in doubt about the intentions of our ally, meaning France. One diarist for Mass Observation, Evelyn Saunders, wrote, "Churchill's speech yesterday hasn't raised my spirits yet. I still feel sick through me." But the audience Churchill had mainly in mind when he'd crafted his speech was, once again, America. And there it was viewed as an unequivocal success, as might be expected, since the hills and beaches to be fought upon were 4,000 miles away. Though he never mentioned America directly, Churchill intended that his speech communicate to Roosevelt and Congress that whatever the setback of Dunkirk, and regardless of what France did next, Britain was wholly committed to victory. The speech also sent a signal to Hitler, reiterating Churchill's resolve to fight on. Whether the speech had anything to do with it or not, the next day, Wednesday, June 5th, German aircraft began bombing targets on the English mainland for the first time, deploying a few bombers, accompanied by clouds of fighters. This raid, and others that immediately followed, perplexed RAF commanders. The Luftwaffe lost aircraft and men largely in vain. In the course of one night's raids, bombs fell onto pastures and forests around Devon, Cornwall, Gloucestershire and elsewhere, doing little damage. The RAF presumed these to be practice raids, meant to test England's defences in preparation for the invasion to come. Hitler, as feared, seemed now to have turned his gaze toward the British Isles. Chapter 9. Mirror Image.
One thing Churchill did not address in his speech was an underappreciated element of the Dunkirk evacuation. To those who cared to look, the fact that more than 300,000 men had managed to cross the Channel in the face of concerted aerial and ground attack carried a darker lesson. It suggested that deterring a massive German invasion force might be more difficult than British commanders had assumed, especially if that force, like the evacuation fleet at Dunkirk, was composed of many hundreds of small ships, barges, and speedboats. Wrote General Edmund Ironside, commander of Britain's home forces, "It brings me to the fact that the Boche may actually well be able to land men in England despite RAF bombing." He feared, in effect, a reverse Dunkirk. Chapter 10. Apparition. Monday, June 10th, found Churchill in a foul mood, one of those rare times when the war eroded his outward buoyancy. Italy had declared war on Britain and France, drawing from him a minatory quip. "People who go to Italy to look at ruins won't have to go as far as Naples and Pompeii in future." This and the situation in France combined to make No. 10 Downing Street a stormy locale. "He was in a very bad temper," wrote Jock Colville, "snapped almost everybody's head off, wrote angry minutes to the First Sea Lord, and refused to pay any attention to messages given him orally." When Churchill was in such a mood, it was usually the person nearest at hand who caught the brunt of it, and that person was often his loyal and long-suffering detective, Inspector Thompson. "He would turn on any handy person and let off steam," Thompson recalled. "Because I was always handy, I got a good many of these scaldings. Nothing I seemed to do appeared correct in his eyes. I bored him. The necessity of my job bored him. My everlasting ubiquity must have bored him to death. It even bored me." Churchill's sniping at times disheartened Thompson and made him feel a failure. "I kept wishing somebody would attack him so I could shoot the attacker," he wrote. It was also the case, however, that Churchill's hostile moods faded quickly. He would never apologize, but he managed to communicate through other means that the storm had passed. "He has been accused of being bad-tempered," explained Lord Beaverbrook, who, as Minister of Aircraft Production, was himself often a target of Churchill's ire. "It isn't true. He could get very emotional, but after bitterly criticizing you, he had a habit of touching you, of putting his hand on your hand, like that, as if to say that his real feelings for you were not changed. A wonderful display of humanity." The weather did not help. In a departure from the long stretch of warmth and sun, the day was dark, eerily so. "Pitch dark," wrote Alexander Cadogan, Under-Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, Britain's senior diplomat, a prominent diarist of the era. Another diarist, Olivia Cockett, a clerk with Scotland Yard and a prolific member of the Mass Observation Panel, wrote, "The black, heavy clouds continue all day, though no rain falls, and they are the chief subject of conversation, rather touchy moods all round. She overheard someone say, 'The day Christ was crucified, it came dark like this. Something terrible will happen.'" Churchill's main preoccupation was France. It irked him that, despite his several trips to France, he remained powerless to influence events and to ignite a French resurgence. Paris was expected to fall within 48 hours, and the French seemed certain to capitulate. He had not yet given up, however. He still believed that with his presence, his encouragement, perhaps some stirring remark or pledge, he might be able to revive the French corps. He got the chance on Tuesday, June 11th, when Prime Minister Reynaud summoned him again, this time to Briare, a small town on the Loire, 100 miles south of Paris. The conference sparked nothing. It merely underscored how bad things had gotten. Hoping to rouse the Prime Minister, Churchill, in a rush of bad French and good English, vowed to fight on no matter what, alone if necessary. "On and on and on, toujours, all the time, everywhere. Partout, pas de grâce, no mercy, puis la victoire." The French were unmoved. The meeting did succeed, however, in searing into the minds of several French officers a singular image, that of Churchill, angered by the French failure to prepare his afternoon bath, bursting through a set of double doors wearing a red kimono and a white belt, exclaiming, "Où est ma bain?" His French version of the question, "Where is my bath?" One witness reported that in his fury he looked like an angry Japanese genie. So disconsolate were the French, and clearly so close to giving up, that Churchill renewed his determination not to send RAF fighters to help. He told the French he was not being selfish, merely prudent, that only the fighter force could stop the expected assault against England. "We grieve that we cannot help more," he said, "but we cannot." For Jock Colville, there was personal anxiety as well. He knew that many of the British soldiers still in France were being evacuated from Cherbourg, and he hoped his brother Philip was among them. Some of Philip's luggage had arrived in London, a hopeful sign, but much danger remained. With both of his brothers in the war, and so many of his peers, Colville now decided that he too needed to join the fight. He believed that the best path lay through the Royal Navy, and he told this to his immediate boss, Eric Seal, Churchill's senior private secretary. Seal promised to help, but found he could do nothing. A lot of young men throughout Whitehall had the same aspirations as Colville, including many in the diplomatic service, and this had become a problem. For the time being, at least, the Foreign Office was refusing to release any of its young men for military duty. Colville resolved to keep trying. On Wednesday, June 12th, as Churchill and his party concluded their meetings in France, U.S. Ambassador Joseph Kennedy sent a confidential cable to his chief, Secretary of State Cordell Hull, offering another jaundiced appraisal of England's prospects. "The Empire's preparedness was," he related, "appallingly weak relative to Germany's great strength. Pitiful," he wrote. "All England possessed was courage. What kept Churchill going," Kennedy stated, "was his belief that the United States would enter the war soon after the upcoming presidential election, on November 5th, in which Roosevelt seemed increasingly likely to run. Churchill," he wrote, "believed that when the people in the United States see the towns and cities of England, after which so many American cities and towns have been named, bombed and destroyed, they will line up and want war." Kennedy cited a report from an English correspondent in America who had written that all that was needed was an incident to bring the United States in. Kennedy found this alarming. "If that were all that were needed, desperate people will do desperate things," he warned. There was forbidding news from another quarter. That Wednesday morning, June 12th, Churchill's newly appointed personal scientific adviser, Frederick Lindemann, known universally as the Prof, convened a meeting with a young scientist from the intelligence branch of the Air Ministry, Dr. Reginald V. Jones, a former student of his who now, at the age of 28, had the lofty title of Deputy Director of Intelligence Research. The meeting was supposed to focus on whether Germany had succeeded in developing and deploying its own radar system, something the British had done before the war and now used to great and secret advantage, with a network of coastal towers, the chain home stations, that gave accurate advance warning of the approach of German aircraft. The meeting, however, soon veered in another direction to reveal a terrifying prospect, a technological advance that, if real, would give Germany a huge advantage in the air war. Part 2. A Certain Eventuality. June to August. Chapter 11. The Mystery of Swan Castle. The Prof, Lindemann, listened with growing scepticism. What Dr. Jones, the young Air Force intelligence man, was now proposing went against all that physicists understood about the propagation of radio waves over long distances. The bits of intelligence Jones presented were compelling, but they surely meant something other than what Jones imagined. It was the Prof's job to assess the world with scientific objectivity. 54 years old, an Oxford physicist, he was one of the first men Churchill had brought into his ministry, in accord with the Prime Minister's belief that, in this new war, advances in technology would play an important role. This had already proved the case with radar, a happy byproduct of far less successful research into the feasibility of creating a death ray capable of destroying aircraft outright. Likewise, the British were becoming adept at intercepting and decrypting Luftwaffe communications, these processed at Bletchley Park, the ultra-secret home of the government code and cipher school, where codebreakers had cracked the secrets of the German Enigma encryption machine. Lindemann had previously run an Admiralty office, established to provide Churchill, as First Lord, with as rich a grasp as possible of the day-to-day readiness of the Royal Navy. Immediately after becoming Prime Minister, Churchill put Lindemann in charge of a successor bureau with a much broader purview, the Prime Minister's Statistical Department, and made him his special scientific adviser with the formal title of Personal Assistant to the Prime Minister. Together, the two roles gave Lindemann license to explore any scientific, technical, or economic matter that might influence the progress of the war, a compelling mandate, but one certain to ignite jealousy within the ministerial fiefdoms of Whitehall. What further complicated things was Lindemann himself, whose main achievement, according to Foreign Affairs Under-Secretary Cadogan, was to unite against him any body of men with whom he came in contact. He was a tall, pale man, given to wearing stiff-fronted, boiled shirts, rigid collars, and ties knotted to a wasp's waist at his neck. His pallor matched the grey of his suits. He always wore an immense black bowler and an overcoat with a velvet collar, and carried an umbrella. His expression was invariably one of contemptuous appraisal, this imparted by lips perpetually turned down at the ends. He seemed ageless, or rather always aged, recalled Lady Juliet Townsend, daughter of Lord Birkenhead, a close friend of Lindemann's and his eventual biographer. "I think he was probably one of those people who got to look quite old quite early on," she said, "and then just went on looking the same for 20 years. It was Townsend who, as a child, assigned Lindemann the nickname Prof. Whether one called him Prof or the Prof was a matter of personal preference. Contradiction defined Lindemann. He hated black people, and yet for years played tennis with a doubles partner who was West Indian. He disliked Jews, on one occasion describing a fellow physicist as a dirty little Jew, yet counted Albert Einstein as a friend, and during Hitler's rise, helped Jewish physicists escape Germany. He was binary in his affections. His friends could do no wrong, his enemies no right. Once crossed, he remained so for life. His memory, wrote John Colville, was not just comprehensive. In recording past slights, it was elephantine. And yet, by all counts, women and children loved him. He was a favourite of Churchill's family and never forgot a birthday. He was beloved in particular by Clementine, who had little affection for most of the ministers and generals with whom Churchill associated. Lindemann's outward austerity masked an inner sensitivity to public perception, sufficiently profound that he would never wear a wristwatch for fear it looked unmanly. He was assiduous about keeping secret the pet name his parents had given him as a child, Peach. He had to be the best at whatever he pursued, and played tennis at a nearly professional level, once even competing in a doubles match at Wimbledon. He often played with Clementine, but never exhibited any outward sense of joy, according to his sister, Linda. He seemed always to be fighting some interior battle. Peach at luncheon, shining with quite appalling general knowledge, which made all conversation a nightmare of pitfalls. Peach determinedly playing chess, playing tennis, playing the piano. Poor Peach, never really playing at all. Through an accident of timing that Lindemann attributed to the selfishness of his mother, he was born not in England, but in Germany, at the Spa town of Baden-Baden on April 5, 1886. The fact that she knew her time was drawing near, and yet chose to give birth to him on German territory, was a source of lifelong annoyance to Lindemann, wrote Lord Birkenhead. Lindemann saw himself as anything but German, and in fact loathed Germany, yet because of his birthplace found himself during the past war, and now again during the new one, the target of suspicions as to his national allegiance. Even Colville noted early on, his foreign connections are fishy. Lindemann's mother had another lasting influence that later shaped how people viewed him. It was she who, while he was a child, placed him and his siblings on a strict vegetarian diet. She and the rest soon abandoned the regimen. He alone held to it, and with a vengeful obstinance. Day after day, he consumed enormous quantities of egg whites, never the yolks, and mayonnaise made from olive oil. He also had a sweet tooth of the first magnitude, with a special passion for filled chocolates, in particular Fuller's chocolate creams. By his own careful measure, he consumed up to 200 grams of sugar a day, equivalent to 48 teaspoons. Lindemann and Churchill first met in the summer of 1921 at a dinner in London, and over time became friends. In 1932, they toured Germany together to visit battlefields fought upon by Churchill's ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough, about whom Churchill was then writing a biography. While tooling around the countryside in the Prof's Rolls-Royce, he had inherited great wealth upon the death of his father, they became aware of an undercurrent of bellicose nationalism. Alarmed, they began working together to collect as much information as possible about the rise of militarism in Hitler's Germany and to awaken Britain to the coming danger. Churchill's home became a kind of intelligence centre for amassing inside information about Germany. Lindemann felt a professional kinship with Churchill. He saw him as a man who should have been a scientist but had missed his vocation. Churchill, in turn, marvelled at Lindemann's ability to recall details and to distill complex subjects to their fundamental elements. He often described the prof as having a beautiful brain. Lindemann's meeting with Dr. Jones began, as planned, with the question of whether Germany had mastered the art of detecting aircraft using radio waves. Jones was certain the Germans had done so, and cited intelligence to support his view. As the meeting came to a close, Jones changed the subject. Something had happened earlier that day that troubled him. A colleague, Group Captain L.F. Blandy, head of the RAF unit responsible for listening in on German radio transmissions, had given Jones a copy of a Luftwaffe message deciphered at Bletchley Park. "Does this mean anything to you?" Blandy had asked. "It doesn't seem to mean much to anybody here." The message was brief and included a geographic position rendered in latitude and longitude, along with what appeared to be two German nouns, Klevis and Knickerbein. As best Jones could make out, the message translated said, "Klevis Knickerbein is confirmed or established at position 53 degrees 24 minutes north and 1 degree west." Jones was startled. The message, he told Blandy, meant everything to him. It fit into a mosaic that lay partially completed at the back of his mind, consisting of fragments of intelligence that had drawn his attention over the preceding months. He had seen the word Knickerbein once before, on a piece of paper found in the wreckage of a German bomber, downed in March 1940. It bore the phrase, "Radio Beacon Knickerbein." More recently, after the RAF's Air Intelligence Branch had made it routine practice to eavesdrop on conversations between prisoners, he had listened to a recording of two captured German flyers discussing what seemed to be a secret wireless navigation system. And then came this latest message. Jones knew that Knickerbein in English meant crooked leg or dog's leg, and he believed that Klevis most likely referred to a town in Germany. The town had a famous castle, Schwanenburg, or Swan Castle, where supposedly Anne of Cleves resided before heading to England to become the fourth wife of Henry VIII. Swan Castle and the legend of the knight Lohengrin were thought to have influenced Wagner in his creation of the famed opera that bears the knight's name. Suddenly the pieces fit together in a way that made sense to Jones, though what he concluded seemed improbable. He was 28 years old. If wrong, he would seem a fool. But if he was right, his discovery could save untold numbers of lives. He knew that the geographic coordinates cited in the newly intercepted message identified a point south of the town of Retford in England's industrial Midlands. A line drawn from Klevis to Retford would delineate a vector, possibly an aircraft's course or radio transmission, a beam or beacon, as evinced by the phrase "radio beacon Knickerbein." The term "crooked leg" suggested an intersection of some kind, and by Jones's reckoning, raised the possibility that a second beam might intersect the first. This would have the effect of marking a precise geographic location on the ground, perhaps a city, or even an individual factory. A technology already existed to guide commercial and military aircraft using radio beams, but only over short distances, to help them land in conditions of limited visibility. Known as the Lorentz Blind Landing System, after its inventor, C. Lorentz, A.G. of Germany, the technology was familiar to both sides and was in use at airports and military airfields in England and Germany. It struck Jones that the Luftwaffe might have found a way to project a Relentz-like beam all the way across the channel to targets inside England. The prospect was deeply troubling. As things stood now, bomber pilots flying at night needed clear skies and moonlight if they hoped to achieve any degree of accuracy. With a system of the kind Jones imagined, German bombers could range over England on any night without having to wait for a full moon or its brightest waxing and waning phases, even in weather that would keep RAF fighters grounded. The RAF was confident that it could counter air raids conducted by day, but at night its fighters had little ability to find and engage enemy aircraft, despite England's radar network. Combat required visual contact, and ground radar simply was not precise enough to bring RAF pilots close enough to afford it. By the time the pilots received radar fixes from controllers at fighter command, the German bombers would already be in a different location, possibly at new altitudes and on different headings. Now, at his morning meeting with the prof, Jones laid out his theory. He was excited, certain that he had stumbled on a secret new German technology. But Lindemann, pallid, ascetic, lips turned down as always, told him that what he proposed was impossible. Conventional blind landing beams travelled only in straight lines, meaning that, owing to the curvature of the Earth, by the time a beam from Germany travelled the needed 200 or more miles to the skies above a given target in England, it would be beyond the reach of even the highest flying bomber. This was accepted doctrine, and Lindemann, once convinced of a thing, was a very hard man to bend. As one close associate, Roy Harrod, put it, "I have never met anyone who, when once he was convinced by his own reasonings, was so deeply and unshakably convinced." Discouraged, but not yet vanquished, Jones returned to his office to consider his next move. He arranged a second meeting with Lindemann for the next day. At 11 o'clock on Thursday morning, Churchill again took off for France, for what would prove to be his last face-to-face meeting with French leaders. He brought Puggisme, Halifax, Cadogan, and Major General Edward Spears, the British liaison to the French army, and this time even Lord Beaverbrook, once again putting at risk a significant portion of Britain's government. The airfield to which they were headed, at Tours, had been bombed just the night before. For Mary Churchill and her mother, the flight meant another day of anxiety. "I do hate it when it goes," Mary wrote in her diary. "We all have a ghastly premonition that the French are going to give in. Oh, God, France can't do it. She must go on. She must go on." The field was deserted and desolate, cratered from the night's raid. French flyers lazed among the hangars, showing little interest in the new arrivals. Churchill walked up to a group of airmen and introduced himself in awful French as Britain's Prime Minister. They gave him a small touring car, hard for Churchill to fit into, let alone Halifax, who was 6 feet 5 inches tall. Thus crammed into the car, like characters in a slapstick movie, they set off for the local prefecture, which housed local representatives of the national government. Here they found just two officials, French Prime Minister Renault and his Under-Secretary for Foreign Affairs, Paul Baudouin. Renault sat behind a desk. Churchill chose a deep armchair and nearly disappeared from view. Unlike at the previous meeting in Briard, Churchill made no effort to appear affable. "He looked extremely stern and concentrated," wrote General Spears. Puggisme, no longer the lovable human canine, also wore a severe expression. Beaverbrook jingled coins in his pocket, as if feeling for a coin with which to tip someone, Spears observed. His face was flushed, his hair, what little he had, wild. His round head looked like a cannonball that might be projected at any moment at Renault by the powerful spring his small, tense body provided. The French were clearly bent on surrender and seemed impatient to get the meeting over with. "At this point," Renault said, "everything depended on what the United States would do. He planned to cable Roosevelt immediately. For the moment," he noted, "the only move open to us is to put the situation to the American president with the greatest frankness." Churchill promised to do likewise, then asked for a moment alone with his colleagues. "Dans le jardin," he commanded. They retreated to a bleak rectangular garden lined with a narrow path and marched in repeated circuits. "I believe that everyone was too stunned to speak," Spears wrote. "I certainly was." Abruptly, Beaverbrook broke the silence. All they could do now, he said, was wait for Roosevelt's response. Fearing that Churchill might rashly promise anew to dispatch squadrons of RAF fighters, Beaverbrook urged him not to make any last-minute pledges. We are doing no good here, he said. In fact, listening to these declarations of Reynaud's only does harm. Let's get along home. They returned to England at dusk. For his second meeting with the Prof, young Dr. Jones came more heavily armed. Jones knew that England's top radio wave expert, Thomas L. Eckersley, a veteran research engineer with the Marconi Company, had once written a short paper in which he'd calculated that a very narrow beam might indeed bend with the curvature of the Earth, and therefore could be marshalled to guide a bomber from Germany to Britain. Now Jones brought along Eckersley's paper, as well as some new bits of intelligence. By way of further preparation, Jones had contacted a friend and colleague, Group Captain Samuel Dennis Falcon, in charge of interrogating Luftwaffe crew members. Jones knew that bombers shot down in recent days had yielded new prisoners for interrogation, so he had asked Falcon to include questions focused specifically on beam guidance technology. Falcon did so, but the direct questions yielded nothing new. Falcon, however, had developed an effective new way of harvesting intelligence from prisoners. After an interrogation session, he would reunite the subject with his fellow airmen, then eavesdrop via hidden microphones as they discussed the interview and the questions asked. Falcon returned one of the new prisoners to his cell and listened in as he told a cellmate that no matter how hard the RAF looked, they would never find the equipment. Which, of course, piqued Jones's curiosity. The prisoner's remark provided oblique confirmation that Jones was on the right track. It also suggested that the device might, in fact, be hidden in plain sight. Jones immediately requested a copy of a technical report made after British investigators had examined a bomber shot down the previous fall, the same kind of bomber in which the prisoner had flown. Jones focused on its radio equipment. One instrument caught his attention, a device identified in the report as a blind landing receiver. This in itself was not surprising, since all German bombers were equipped with standard Lorenz landing systems. The report showed that the equipment had been closely examined by an engineer at the Royal Aircraft Factory, an experimental aviation unit. Jones called him. "Tell me," he said, "is there anything unusual about the blind landing receiver?" The engineer said no, then qualified his answer. "But now you mention it," he said, "it is much more sensitive than they would ever need for blind landing. The device could be tuned to particular frequencies, which, Jones reasoned, must be the ranges at which the new beam system operated, provided, of course, that his hunch was correct. As inclined as Lindemann was to stand his ground, he was also receptive to cool scientific logic. It was one thing to listen to a 28-year-old scientist propose the existence of a secret new German guidance technology, working from a few pieces of circumstantial evidence, but quite another to see in clear, hard numbers the calculations of a leading expert purporting to prove that the underlying radio physics could permit the creation of such a system. And the new evidence Jones had collected was compelling. Lindemann now recognized that if the Luftwaffe had managed to harness this new technology, it was indeed a fearsome development. Jones believed the beam could place an aircraft within 400 yards of a target, a startling degree of precision. Leveraging the power of his direct connection to Churchill, Lindemann that day composed an urgent minute for delivery direct to the Prime Minister. It was this intimate, Rasputin-like link that raised so much suspicion and jealousy among Lindemann's peers. With his exalted new mandate, anything and everything now came within his purview. He could probe the most remote corners of government and question whatever he wished, even propose new weapons and weigh in on military strategy and, in so doing, upset the lives of bureaucrats both lofty and low. He was as obstinate as a mule, and unwilling to admit that there was any problem under the sun which he was not qualified to solve, recalled Pagisme. He would write a memorandum on high strategy on one day, and a thesis on egg production on the next. Notes and minutes flew from Lindemann's office, more than 250 by year's end, on such diverse subjects as nitroglycerin, timber supplies, and secret anti-aircraft weapons. These often prompted Churchill to demand some new action from his various ministers, thereby disrupting their already pressured lives. One never knew during a meeting whether Churchill, forearmed by Lindemann, would suddenly flourish a statistical rapier that would eviscerate a demand or argument, or whether Lindemann himself, with his quiet, raspy voice, would conduct the evisceration. As Lindemann grew more comfortable in the job, he would append to his notes a draft of a minute for Churchill to initial, written in a voice approximating Churchill's, careful to mask his own role in the process. But this was what Churchill wanted from Lindemann, to challenge the orthodox, the tried and true, and thereby spark greater efficiency. The prof delighted in coming up with ideas that turned conventional beliefs upside down. Once, as he was walking with a colleague, Donald MacDougall, he saw a poster that admonished, "Stop that dripping tap," an exhortation meant to conserve water and thereby save the coal that fueled the water distribution system. As he walked, the prof began calculating the costs in energy, wood pulp, and shipping needed to produce the paper for the posters. And of course, MacDougall recalled, Prof was right in his initial suspicion that it all added up to enormously more than was going to be saved by the poster's advice being followed. In his minute to Churchill about Dr. Jones's apparent discovery, Lindemann kept his tone dispassionate. There seems some reason to suppose that the Germans have some type of radio device with which they hope to find their targets, he wrote. The exact nature of the technology was unclear, but might, he hypothesized, involve some kind of beam, or possibly radio beacons installed in England by spies. Regardless, Lindemann wrote, it is vital to investigate, and especially to discover what the wavelength is. If we knew this, we could devise means to mislead them. He asked Churchill's permission to take this up with the Air Ministry and try and stimulate action. Churchill took the information seriously from the first, later recalling that he received the news as a painful shock. He forwarded the prof's minute to Air Ministry Chief Archibald Sinclair with a handwritten note. This seems most intriguing, and I hope you will have it thoroughly examined. Coming from Churchill, this was like being prodded with a whip. Sinclair acted immediately, though grudgingly, and appointed a senior Air Ministry official to investigate Jones's theory. Now came moving day for the Churchills. On Friday, June 14th, with deposed Prime Minister Chamberlain having at last left 10 Downing Street, the Churchills began transferring their belongings from Admiralty House into their new residential quarters. Clementine directed the operation. Moving in any era was a stressful affair, but the strain certainly was amplified by the fact that France was about to fall and invasion loomed. Clementine, however, seemed to weather it well, as her friend Violet Bonham Carter, the once suspected rival, found when she stopped at Admiralty House for tea just a few days before the move. The house was still fully decorated and furnished. It was looking cool and delicious, full of flowers, and all their lovely pictures lit up, she wrote in her diary on June 11th. Clemmy was absolutely her normal self, chirrupy, very sweet, and always a little more amusing than one expects to find her. The move took several days, during which Mary and Clementine stayed at the Carlton Hotel, also the prof's temporary residence. Choosing to avoid domestic chaos, Churchill stayed with Lord Beaverbrook in his London mansion, Stornoway House, headquarters of the Ministry of Aircraft Production. The Churchills brought to 10 Downing a new family member, the Admiralty's black cat, Nelson, named after Vice Admiral Horatio Nelson, hero of the British naval victory at Trafalgar. Churchill adored the cat and often carried him about the house. Nelson's arrival caused a certain degree of feline strife, according to Mary, for Nelson harassed the cat that already resided at 10 Downing, whose nickname was the Munich Mouser. There was much to arrange, of course, as in any household, but an inventory for 10 Downing hints at the complexity that awaited Clementine. Wine glasses and tumblers, the whiskey had to go somewhere. Grapefruit glasses, meat dishes, sieves, whisks, knives, jugs, breakfast cups and saucers, needles for trussing poultry, bedroom carafes and tumblers, 36 bottles of furniture polish, 27 pounds of carbolic soap, 150 pounds of primrose soap in bars, and 78 pounds of brown Windsor soap, a favourite of both Napoleon and Queen Victoria. There were banister brushes, both bristle and whisk, Are you bank automatic floor sweeper, hearth brushes, kneeling mats, mops and handles for mops, and heads for special do-all mops, as well as chamois leathers, 8 pounds of rags, and 24 dozen matches for lighting hearths and cigars alike? The Chamberlains have left the place very dirty, Mary wrote in her diary the next day. Mummy has left the Admiralty House like a new pin. Mary loved her new home, particularly its dignified air. The front door was painted with black enamel and had a lion's head knocker. It was guarded by a uniformed doorman and a police officer. Churchill's private study and the famed cabinet room were on the ground floor, where a stately quiet prevailed, as if the clamour of daily life were muffled by the sheer weight of British history. His paintings hung in the halls. The family quarters were upstairs on the second floor, what Americans called the third, linked by halls painted eggshell blue with carpet the colour of tomatoes. Sashed windows overlooked the garden and the rear entrance of the house and the Horse Guards Parade, a broad gravelled plaza upon which important ceremonial events took place. To Mary, this floor evoked a country home. Here, as at Admiralty House, Churchill and Clementine kept separate bedrooms. Mary especially liked the rooms assigned to her. "Mummy has given me a lovely bedroom, sitting room, and most spacious clothes closet, this latter most Hollywood," she wrote. With her father as Prime Minister, she was at the centre of things now. It was all very stirring and romantic. That the Luftwaffe would soon evict Mary from her lovely rooms, and from London itself, was a thought that at this point, judging by the tenor of her diary, never entered her mind. Fulfilling his promise to the French, late on Saturday afternoon, June 15th, Churchill dictated a telegram to President Roosevelt that contained his most ardent plea yet. The process of dictation invariably strained the patience of whomever was in attendance, typically his primary personal secretary, Mrs. Hill, and a private secretary, in this case John Colville. As Colville wrote later, "To watch him compose some telegram or minute for dictation is to make one feel that one is present at the birth of a child. So tense is his expression, so restless his turnings from side to side, so curious the noises he emits under his breath." The ritual was especially painstaking for telegrams as sensitive as this one. "I understand all your difficulties with American public opinion and Congress," Churchill dictated, "but events are moving downward at a pace where they will pass beyond the control of American public opinion when at last it is ripened." France was confronting an existential crisis, and the only force capable of influencing her future was America. A declaration that the United States will, if necessary, enter the war might save France, he said. "Failing that, in a few days, French resistance may have crumbled and we shall be left alone." But far more than France was at stake, he added. He raised the spectre of Britain, too, succumbing to Hitler's influence, and warned that a new and pro-German government might then replace his own. "If we go down, you may have a United States of Europe under the Nazi command far more numerous, far stronger, far better armed than the New World." He reprised his earlier request that the United States send destroyers to bolster the Royal Navy, and backed it up with a paper that detailed just how urgently the destroyers were needed in light of the expected invasion. The paper, echoing Home Forces Commander General Ironside's earlier concerns about a reverse Dunkirk, warned that a German invasion from the sea will most certainly be in the form of dispersed landings from a large number of small craft, and the only effective counter to such a move is to maintain numerous and effective destroyer patrols. But the Royal Navy, the report cautioned, had only 68 operational destroyers. The need for more was therefore crucial. "Here," Churchill wrote, "is a definite, practical and possible decisive step which can be taken at once, and I urge most earnestly that you will weigh my words." He called receipt of the destroyers a matter of life or death. After completing this telegram and another to the Prime Ministers of Canada and Britain's other dominions, Churchill turned to John Colville and quipped, "If words counted, we should win this war." Though sympathetic, Roosevelt remained hamstrung by neutrality laws and the isolationist bent of the American public. Soon afterward, Colville found himself whisked off to the countryside for a weekend at what was fast becoming for Churchill a kind of secret weapon, the official prime ministerial estate, Chequers, in Buckinghamshire, 40 miles northwest of London. Chapter 12. The Ghosts of Dull People. The three black Daimlers sped through the countryside in fading light. Churchill liked to go fast. With luck and daring, his driver could cover the distance from Downing Street to Chequers in an hour. If he did it in 50 minutes, a feat that required running traffic lights and ignoring rights of way, he won Churchill's generous praise. On one return trip, he was said to have hit 70 miles per hour, this in an age when cars had no seatbelts. Churchill was invariably accompanied in the back seat by a typist, for whom the ride could be hair-raising. Wrote Secretary Elizabeth Leighton of a later experience, "One would sit with book, balanced on one knee, scribbling hard, one's left hand holding spare pencils, his glasses case or an extra cigar, sometimes with one's foot keeping open his precious box, which otherwise would have slammed shut as we swung around a corner." Shorthand was allowed only in cars. The rest of the time, Churchill's dictation had to be typed. Inspector Thompson came along as well, his anxiety rising as he approached the house, which he deemed an ideal setting for an assassination. Owing to the thoughtful gift of its prior owner, Sir Arthur Lee, the house, a large Tudor mansion of turmeric-hued brick, had been the official country home of British Prime Ministers since 1917, when Lee gave it to the government. "A police officer, even with his health and a revolver, could feel very alone there," Thompson wrote, "and very unsafe." The procession entered the grounds through a large wrought-iron gate, which was flanked on both sides by brick lodges. Soldiers of the Coldstream Guards patrolled the grounds. Police officers manned the lodges and stopped the cars to check identities. Even Churchill's driver was questioned. The cars then proceeded down a long straight lane called Victory Way. Banks of tall windows would, in peacetime, have been filled with a welcoming amber light, but now were dark, in accord with the strict blackout rules in place throughout the country. The cars entered a semicircular drive and came to a stop before the main entrance, on the east side of the house, where the party was greeted by Miss Grace Lamont, Monty, a Scot who had managed the house for its prime ministerial tenants since 1937. Her official title was Lady Housekeeper. The terms of Lee's gift specified that no work was to be done at the house, that it was to be a place of rest and renewal. Lee had written, "Apart from these subtle influences, the better the health of our rulers, the more sanely will they rule, and the inducement to spend 2 days a week in the high and pure air of the Chiltern Hills and woods will, it is hoped, result in a real advantage to the nation as well as to its chosen leaders." It was indeed an idyllic locale. "Happy Prime Ministers, whichever way you go, fresh beauties meet you," wrote Hubert Astley, a descendant of an early owner. The house stood in a shallow valley of the Chilterns, surrounded on three sides by rising terrain, laced with paths that led walkers among yew hedges, ponds and copses of beech, larch and holly, delicately patrolled by chalk-blue butterflies. One of the estate's comely forests was the Long Walk Wood, happily and densely populated with rabbits. The immediate grounds had a croquet lawn, which delighted Clementine, an avid and demanding player. Churchill would soon put the croquet lawn to secondary use, testing novel military weapons, some the brainchildren of the Prof. Off the south end of the house was an ancient sundial with a gloomy inscription, "The hours do fly, full soon we die, in age secure, the house and hills alone endure." The front door opened onto an entry passage that led to the great hall, whose walls rose the full height of the house and displayed 30 large paintings, including Rembrandt's The Mathematician. The painting was later determined to have been done by one of Rembrandt's students. The entire house embodied the grand sweep of British history, but it was in the long gallery, on the second floor, that a sense of the past was most palpable. Here stood a table used by Napoleon Bonaparte during his exile on St. Helena. On the mantel of the large fireplace lay two swords, once wielded by Oliver Cromwell, one of which supposedly accompanied him into battle at Marston Moor in 1644. To the left of the fireplace hung the cheery letter written by him from the scene, with the notable line, "God made them as stubble to our swords." The house was not to everyone's taste. Lloyd George disliked the fact that it was situated in a hollow and thus afforded only constricted views of the countryside. The house, he said, was full of the ghosts of dull people, and this, he mused, might explain why his dog, Chong, tended to growl in the long gallery. Churchill visited the house during Lloyd George's tenure, in February 1921, a visit that must surely have stoked his lust to one day be Prime Minister. "Here I am," he wrote to Clementine about his visit. "You would like to see this place. Perhaps you will some day. It is just the kind of house you admire, a panelled museum full of history, full of treasures, but insufficiently warmed. Anyhow, a wonderful possession." Churchill quickly demonstrated that he had no intention of honouring Arthur Lee's demand that Prime Ministers leave their work behind. Dinner on that Saturday, June 15th, was to begin at 9:30. The cook, alerted that the prof would be a guest, prepared a special meal for him, suited to his vegetarian palate. He favoured asparagus omelettes, lettuce salads, and tomatoes, first peeled, then sliced, anything, basically, that could be matched with eggs and olive oil-based mayonnaise. Clementine did not mind bending the culinary apparatus of the house to accommodate the prof. "My mother took endless trouble," Mary recalled. "There was always a special, different dish cooked for prof, endless egg dishes, and he would carefully pick out the yolks and eat the whites. Meals aside, he was an easy guest. Prof was never a worry," Mary wrote. "He wasn't any trouble to entertain. He would take himself off to play golf, or he was working, or he was enlightening Papa, or he was playing tennis. He was a totally wonderful guest." As welcome as he was, Mary had her reservations. "I always rather dreaded sitting next to Prof, as he didn't make many jokes, and for a young person he was a little boring. I never felt cosy with Prof. He was absolutely charming," she remarked, "but he was a different animal altogether." Neither Clementine nor Mary was present that Saturday night, presumably having chosen to stay behind to continue the process of moving the family, and Nelson, into No. 10 Downing. The guests who would stay the night included Churchill's daughter Diana and her husband, Duncan Sands, and the ever-present John Colville. The prof, leery of encountering others while on his way to the bath, never stayed overnight, preferring the privacy and comfort of his rooms at Oxford or his new workday residence at the Carlton Hotel. Shortly before everyone entered the dining room, Colville received a telephone call from a fellow private secretary on duty in London, reporting the grimmest news from France thus far. The French were now openly demanding to be allowed to make their own peace deal with Hitler, in violation of a prior Anglo-French pact. Colville took the news to Churchill, who was immediately very depressed. "At once the atmosphere at Chequers grew funereal," Colville wrote. "Dinner began lugubriously. W eating fast and greedily, his face almost in his plate, every now and then firing some technical question at Lindemann, who was quietly consuming his vegetarian diet. Churchill, troubled and glum, made it clear that, at least for the moment, he had little interest in routine dinner talk and that only Lindemann merited his attention. At length, the house staff served champagne, brandy, and cigars, and these did wonders to lighten the mood. This revitalization over drink and dinner was something of a pattern, as Lord Halifax's wife, Dorothy, had noted in the past. Churchill would be silent, grumpy, and remote at the start of a meal, she wrote, but mellowed by champagne and good food, he became a different man, and a delightful and amusing companion. After Clementine once criticized his drinking, he told her, "Always remember, Clemmy, that I have taken more out of alcohol than alcohol has taken out of me." The talk grew animated. Churchill began reading aloud telegrams of support that had come from far-flung lands within the Empire, this by way of cheering himself up and heartening the others in the party as well. He offered a sobering observation. "The war is bound to become a bloody one for us now, but I hope our people will stand up to bombing and the Huns aren't liking what we are giving them. But what a tragedy that our victory in the last war should have been snatched from us by a lot of softies." By softies, he was referring to supporters of Chamberlain's policy of appeasement. The group went outside to stroll the grounds, with Churchill, son-in-law Duncan, and Inspector Thompson going to the Rose Garden, while Colville, the prof, and Diana headed for the opposite side of the house. The sun had set at 9:19. The moon was up and bright, a waxing gibbous, with a full moon due in 5 days. It was light and deliciously warm, Colville wrote, but the sentries, with tin helmets and fixed bayonets, who were placed all round the house, kept us fully alive to the horrors of reality. Colville was summoned often to the telephone, and each time set out to find Churchill, searching for Winston among the roses, as he put it in his diary. The French, he told Churchill, were moving ever closer to capitulating. Churchill said, "Tell them that if they let us have their fleet, we shall never forget. But if they surrender without consulting us, we shall never forgive. We shall blacken their name for 1,000 years. He paused, then added, "Don't, of course, do that just yet." Despite the news, Churchill's mood continued to improve. He passed out cigars. Matches flickered in the dark. As the coal ends of cigars glowed, he recited poems and discussed the war with an animation that verged on delight. At intervals, he chanted the refrain from a popular song performed by the male duo Flanagan and Allen. "Bang, bang, bang, bang goes the farmer's gun. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, 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 run." The song would become immeasurably more popular later in the war when Flanagan and Allen substituted Adolf for rabbit. A telephone call arrived for Churchill from America's ambassador to Britain, Joseph Kennedy. Colville retrieved Churchill from the garden. His demeanour immediately more grave, Churchill unleashed on Kennedy a flood of eloquence about the part that America could and should play in saving civilization, Colville wrote in his diary. Churchill told the ambassador that America's promises of financial and industrial support constituted a laughingstock on the stage of history. At 1 a.m., Churchill and his guests gathered in the central hall. Churchill lay down on a sofa, puffing his cigar. They told a couple of off-color jokes and talked about the importance of increasing the production of fighters for the RAF. At 1:30 a.m., he rose to go to bed, telling the others, "Good night, my children." That night, in his diary, Colville wrote, "It was at once the most dramatic and the most fantastic evening I have ever spent." Chapter 13. Scarification. At 7:30 on Sunday morning, upon learning that Churchill was awake, Colville brought him the latest report on the French situation, which had arrived earlier both over the telephone and in the form of a document delivered by courier. Colville brought the messages to Churchill's room. Churchill was in bed, looking just like a rather nice pig, clad in a silk vest. Churchill decided to convene a special cabinet meeting at 10:15 that morning in London. As Churchill breakfasted in bed, his valet, Sawyers, ran his bath, and the house roused to action. Mrs. Hill readied her portable typewriter. Inspector Thompson checked for assassins. Churchill's driver prepared the car. Colville raced to dress and pack and rushed through his breakfast. They sped back to London through heavy rain, splashing through stoplights and hurtling along the Mall at high speed, with Churchill all the while dictating minutes to Mrs. Hill and generating a morning's worth of work for Colville and his fellow private secretaries. Churchill arrived at 10 Downing Street just as his cabinet ministers were gathering. The meeting resulted in a telegram to the French, sent at 12:35 p.m., authorizing France to inquire about the terms of an armistice on its own behalf, provided, but only provided, that the French fleet is sailed forthwith for British harbours pending negotiations. The telegram made clear that Britain planned to fight on and would not participate in any deliberations that France pursued with Germany. Churchill knew France was lost. What he cared about most now was the French fleet. If it fell under Hitler's control, as seemed likely, it would change the balance of power on the high seas, where Britain, at least for the time being, retained superiority. In London that Sunday, the Prof and young Dr. Jones of Air Intelligence attended a meeting of the RAF's Night Interception Committee, convened by Air Marshal Philip Joubert, to further consider Jones's apparent discovery of a new German beam navigation system. Churchill, otherwise engaged, did not attend, but the galvanic power of his interest was evident. What had hitherto been the subject of more or less academic interest now became a target of concrete inquiry, with specific tasks assigned to various officers. "What a change," Jones wrote, from my inactivity of only a week ago. But doubts about Jones's theory persisted. One key participant in the meeting, Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding, head of Fighter Command, described Jones's case as consisting of some rather nebulous evidence. Another, Henry Tizard, a prominent scientific advisor to the Air Ministry, wrote, "I may be wrong, but there seemed to me to be unnecessary excitement about this latest alleged German method for dealing with the country. One cannot possibly get accurate bombing on a selected target in this way." The Prof, however, was convinced that the matter was urgent. Lindemann again wrote to Churchill, this time urging him to issue a directive that such investigation take precedence, not only as regards materials, but especially the use of men, over any research whose results are not liable to affect production in the next 3 months. Churchill agreed. On Lindemann's note, he jotted, "Let this be done without fail." Soon Jones heard a rumour that Churchill considered the matter so grave that he planned to convene a meeting on the subject at 10 Downing Street. To Jones, this seemed implausible, very likely the opening move in a multiple-step practical joke by his colleagues in Air Intelligence, who had elevated the art of pulling pranks to a high level. Jones himself was acknowledged to be a foremost practitioner. On Monday, June 17th, a certain eventuality came to pass. France fell. Churchill's cabinet met at 11 a.m. and soon afterward learned that Marshal Philippe Pétain, who that day replaced Renault as leader of France, had ordered the French army to stop fighting. After the meeting, Churchill walked into the garden at 10 Downing alone and began to pace, head down, hands clasped behind his back, not depressed and not cowed, but deep in thought. Colville watched him. He was doubtless considering how best the French fleet, the Air Force and the colonies could be saved. Colville wrote, "He, I am sure, will remain undaunted." Judging by the telegram Churchill sent to Pétain and General Maxime Weygand later that day, this appeared to be the case. Deploying flattery leavened with irony, he began, "I wish to repeat to you my profound conviction that the illustrious Marshal Pétain and the famous General Weygand are comrades in two great wars against the Germans, will not injure their ally by delivering over to the enemy the fine French fleet. Such an act would scarify." Scarify, a 600-year-old word that only Churchill would use in crucial diplomatic correspondence, would scarify their names for 1,000 years of history. Yet this result may easily come by frittering away these few precious hours when the fleet can be sailed to safety in British or American ports, carrying with it the hope of the future and the honour of France. The news about France was first broadcast by the BBC at 1 o'clock that afternoon. Home intelligence reported that the reaction by the public has been one of confusion and shock, but hardly surprise. From all parts come reports of bewilderment and great anxiety. There was widespread fear that the British government might go abroad, or simply give up. A few feel all is over. The two questions most on people's minds were what would happen to the soldiers still in France, will a second Dunkirk be possible, and what would now become of the French Air Force and Navy? It was crucial, the report said, that Churchill or the King come forward that very night to speak. Olivia Cockett, the Scotland Yard clerk and mass observation diarist, was at work when she heard the BBC broadcast. "Poor France," she wrote at 3:40 p.m. "The 1 o'clock news was a bomb to me. I'd said over and over again that I didn't believe France was ever going to give in to Germany. We all fell very silent." The afternoon tea service arrived. Cockett did not share England's national obsession with tea, but today, she said, "I was grateful for a cup for once." She spent the next hour quivering and with tears. But at 10 Downing and Buckingham Palace, there was a new and welcome sense of clarity. "Personally," the King wrote in a letter to his mother, Queen Mary, "I feel happier now that we have no allies to be polite to and to pamper." Air Marshal Dowding was elated, for it meant the end at last of the persistent threat that Churchill, in a rash and generous moment, would send fighters to France and deplete the force needed to repel the massive assault by the German Air Force that was certain to come, now that France had capitulated. Dowding later confessed to Lord Halifax, "I don't mind telling you that when I heard of the French collapse, I went on my knees and thanked God." But all this relief was tempered by an appreciation of just how radically the French collapse altered the strategic landscape. The Luftwaffe was sure now to move its air fleets into bases along the Channel coast. Invasion seemed not only practical but imminent. The British expected it to begin with a massive onslaught by the German Air Force, the much-feared knockout blow. More bad news arrived that afternoon. Churchill was seated in the quiet of the cabinet room at No. 10 Downing when he was told that a large Cunard liner, the Lancastria, which was serving as a troop ship and loaded with more than 6,700 British soldiers, aircrews, and civilians, had been attacked by German aircraft. Three bombs had struck the ship and set it afire. It sank in 20 minutes, with the loss of at least 4,000 lives, far more than the combined tolls of the Titanic and the Lusitania. So wrenching was this news, especially on top of the French debacle, that Churchill barred the press from reporting it. "The newspapers have got quite enough disaster for today, at least," he said. This was, however, a misguided attempt at censorship, given that 2,500 survivors soon arrived in Britain. The New York Times broke the story 5 weeks later, on July 26th, and the British press followed suit. The fact that the government never acknowledged the sinking caused a surge of distrust among the public, according to Home Intelligence. The withholding of the news of the Lancastria is the subject of much adverse criticism, the agency stated in one of its daily reports. The lack of disclosure raised fears that other bad news is withheld, and the fact that the news was only released after publication in an American paper gives rise to the feeling that it would otherwise have been withheld longer. As it happened, the death toll was likely much greater than first reported. The actual number of people aboard the ship was never determined, but could have been as high as 9,000. There was good news, however, from the Ministry of Aircraft Production. On Tuesday, June 18th, Lord Beaverbrook gave the War Cabinet his first report on the output of aircraft. The results were stunning. New aircraft were exiting his factories at a rate of 363 a week, up from 245. The production of engines had soared as well, 620 new engines a week, compared to 411. What he did not report, at least not here, was that these gains had come at considerable cost to himself, in terms of stress and health, and to harmony within Churchill's government. Immediately after accepting his new post, Beaverbrook began clashing with the Air Ministry, which he saw as fusty and hidebound in its approach, not just to building aircraft, but also to deploying and equipping them. He had personal insight into aerial warfare. His son, also named Max and known as Little Max, was a fighter pilot, tall and sharply handsome, soon to win the Distinguished Flying Cross. From time to time, Beaverbrook invited him and his fellow pilots to his home for cocktails and conversation. Beaverbrook lived each day in a state of anxiety until about 8 o'clock each evening, when Little Max would check in by telephone to let him know he was alive and intact. Beaverbrook wanted control of everything: production, repair, storage. The Air Ministry, however, had always considered these its exclusive responsibility. It wanted all the planes it could get, of course, but resented Beaverbrook's intrusions, especially when he sought to dictate even the kinds of guns that should be installed in new aircraft. Beaverbrook infuriated other ministries as well. He wanted first access to all resources: wood, steel, fabric, drills, milling equipment, explosives, anything needed for the manufacture of bombers and fighters, regardless of the needs and demands of other ministries. He would, for example, commandeer buildings already earmarked for other uses. His direct connection to Churchill made his depredations all the more exasperating. As Pug Ismay saw it, Beaverbrook had more in common with a highwayman than an executive. In the pursuit of anything which he wanted, whether materials, machine tools, or labor, he never hesitated, so rival departments alleged, to indulge in barefaced robbery. 2 days before submitting his progress report, Beaverbrook had dictated a 9-page letter to Churchill in which he laid out his troubles. "Today," he began, "I find myself frustrated and abstracted, and I ask for your immediate help." He cited a long list of vexations, including resistance from the Air Ministry to his campaign to salvage and repair downed RAF planes, a province the ministry saw as its own. Beaverbrook recognized from the start that these wrecked planes were a trove of spare components, especially engines and instruments that could be cobbled together into complete aircraft. Many damaged British fighters managed to crash land at airfields, farms and parks, or on other friendly ground, from which they could be readily retrieved. He marshalled the talents of myriad mechanics and small companies to create a repair network so adept at salvage that it could return to battle hundreds of aircraft a month. Beaverbrook demanded full control of maintenance depots where damaged planes and parts accumulated, and claimed that the Air Ministry, out of territorial pique, tried to stymie him at every turn. In his letter to Churchill, he described how one of his salvage squads had recovered 1,600 inoperable Vickers machine guns from one depot and sent them to a factory for repair. He was told there were no more such guns, but this proved not to be true. Yesterday, after an early morning raid, carried out at my instigation, we recovered another batch of 1,120 guns, he wrote. His use of the word raid was emblematic of his approach. His tactics won him no praise from Air Ministry officials, who viewed his emergency salvage crews, his action squads, as the equivalent of roving bands of pirates, and at one point banned the squads from frontline airfields. Beaverbrook never sent the 9-page letter. This change of heart was not unusual. He often dictated complaints and attacks, sometimes in multiple drafts, deciding later not to post them. In the personal papers he eventually left to the archives of Parliament, one big file contains unsent mail, a collection that steams with unvented bile. His dissatisfaction continued to fester and intensify.